Tim does such a great job at this meeting. He does the heavy lifting, and he has for a long time. I try to stay out of his way. But I wanted to introduce our speaker tonight, not just because he's a great man, but because I want to just thank him for what he's meant in my life. I don't want to take but a minute, but if you stay sober long, there are a lot of great days, but there are a few days that change your life. And I met my sponsor, and we talked. You've heard me share many times. You've heard me talk about it. And he said, I want you to go to a men's meeting with me that I go to every week. And a couple of nights later, I was something under 30 days sober, detoxing, and nobody wanted me around. My family didn't want me around. And I went to Wayne's house that night, and I remember walking in, and we shook hands. He doesn't remember it, but I remember it. And right there, we became friends. I wanted to get sober, and that's all he needed to know about me. And I was as welcome there that night as I am here tonight. And it took me a long time to figure it out, but as if you'll hear in the story tonight, I'm sure a lot of things Wayne and I are different about. He's a New Yorker, 30 years, successful, just an amazing guy. I'm a Southern Baptist preacher's son, lived here all my life. But that night, he knew exactly how I felt. And that's what AA is all about, identifying with that newcomer. And he has set a standard there that's amazing in my life. Wayne is the first person that ever asked me to be a discussion leader in a meeting, and I felt like I was auditioning at Carnegie Hall. You've done that, you know what that's like. And he's always encouraged me, I mean, pretty much from the beginning. And he is the gold standard in a lot of things, and I love him, and I just wanted to let you know that, Wayne. And you taught me how to talk to a newcomer, and I still watch you, and you're a great example. Anyway, I love you, and please help me welcome my friend, Wayne.
Wow. Thank you, Tim. I'm Wayne, and I'm an alcoholic. And thank you for having me here. It's been a while, so the butterflies in my stomach are going full force here, but I know that's God working, and I pray that I speak truth, and I'm as honest as I can be here. My sponsor's not here tonight, and I teased him that I could tell a few tales, but he knows me better than that. A lot's gone on in the last few years, so I think that's why I'm a little anxious here, because I've told my story quite a few times, but not with the last 2 years of my life added to it. And it's been interesting, but it's been great. I'll tell you that much. As Tim said, he called me a New Yorker. I have been in the South longer than I was in New York, but I was born and raised in the Bronx. I was born in 1951, which makes me a young 58. My sobriety date is April 5th of 1995, so I spent 44 years out there getting crazy and wild, and I've had 14 and a half years of some sort of peace and serenity, getting better one day at a time. It's really starting to work. However, born the oldest of five children, Archie Bunker for a dad, crew cut, used the crew X, always more military than anything, raised his family like that. His wife was to just be seen and wear what he told her to wear and vote for who he told her to vote for. Very aggressive, very domineering, but a wonderful provider. He worked two jobs, we never were without. But at some point in my young age, 10, 11, I started to wonder why we didn't have the things that everybody else started that had. And I would question that. And I can remember when my mother had the fifth child, I was 14. And I asked her straight out, honest, not being a smart aleck, why didn't you stop at me? So something was going on already at 14. I didn't know it there, but it wasn't about me anymore. There was too much going on. I also learned at an early life that I was sent off to military camp at 10. It was a Episcopal boys camp that was military and sports oriented. And besides the craziness and sanity of that whole experience, it taught me something very early in life that I could be away from home. that I could survive. And I weaned myself away from the family in my head and mind, that I didn't have to always be there, because shortly after I went away to college and then came down here to Georgia, and it was no big deal. It wasn't even a bump. A lot of things went on in that childhood, not only from the selfish thinking, but just all through my education, I never fit in. I never was part of. I was a square peg in a round hole. And from the time I was 3 years old, when my father didn't like something I did and scared the fire out of me, I lived in fear. Fear of not being good enough, fear of getting yelled at. I even love to tell this story because I can remember my mom telling us as youngsters, don't lie. It'll always be better if you tell the truth. But you know, the first time I told the truth, the punishment was more than I thought I deserved. I learned how to lie. Real good. Real good. That I even believed myself. So all these little things, never had alcohol even touched me. Now, alcoholism was in our family, both grandfathers. They weren't called alcoholics. One was a cab driver, but he was always in the bars in Manhattan. And the other one was a bread delivery man for Wonder Bread. And he found himself in what they called the little local pubs. He was always there in the evenings and every Saturday all day. They weren't alcoholics. The family didn't talk about it. The two alcoholics that were active were my mother's brother and my father's brother. My godfather, my middle name is Paul, and he was probably the most active, including trying to stab my father, doing crazy things, always weddings, always drama. And he died at a very young age of 44 from alcoholism. My mother's brother made it till he was 70. He was a New York fireman, but he also died of alcoholism. So it's always been there. My mother also was in the program for many years, but I was tougher than that. I wasn't going to be like that. And so those were the things that went through this youngster's head. Somewhere 15, 16, things started to get very disgruntled in the household. I had an opportunity to, there was a special school in New York that was agriculture related. I was very much into gardening, landscaping, and also animals. I couldn't make up my mind, horticulture or veterinary medicine. Again, I removed myself from my normal setting of school and went to the only school in New York City that offered an ag program. Took 3 city buses, an hour and a half every day to school. But again, I put this square peg into a round hole, and it didn't fit. I had no friends in high school. I used the excuse of the traveling, so I couldn't spend time at the school. Always felt different. Wasn't smart enough. They were very excelled. I didn't make it into Cornell, where most of the folks did, but I made it into a 2-year ag and tech college in upstate New York. When I went there, I was 18 years old, and at 18, you could drink at that time. Now, my first drunk was on my 18th birthday, and that was May 12th of whatever, that was 1969, the year I graduated high school. It was a wonderful drunk, but I blacked out and found myself rolled and mugged on the side of a highway on my very first drunk. And my parents thought it was hilarious, because the wallet was back on the stoop, a few things missing, and I was in one piece. And they laughed at me being green and hoped that that would take effect and I wouldn't do it. It didn't take long. Get me to college, get me around roommates, and off to the races. I found out I stunk at drinking beer and wine. For some reason, early age, I was told I shouldn't drink anything with a lot of sugar in it. There was some childhood diabetes, maybe all that. So gin and tonic was okay. Anything white. Off to the races with gin and tonic. My fraternity mug, I always had my 6 shots of gin and tonic while they were drinking their beer. And I started to pride myself on the fact that I could outdrink anybody. and I didn't black out. I didn't get sick. So I was ready to go, you see, and I wasn't going to be an alcoholic because alcoholics were different. And coming from New York, alcoholics lived in the Bowery, long trench coats, bums, with a little brown bag. So that was my visual at that time, and I watched my uncle, and he was pretty much in that shape. Somewhere in the end of my first year of college and going back to the second, I broke away from the dominance of a pretty harsh dad. Decided to lash out myself on my political views, and also 69-70 was the time of everything happening, all the psychedelics, all the drugs. It started with marijuana, and I just went through the whole gamut. Unfortunately, it didn't mix well with alcohol. That's when I started getting sick and crazy, and so I was trying to make a choice, and I never could. What I really liked was the alcohol. I made it through the 2 years up there, and I got accepted to the University of Georgia, and I was so excited because I was ready to get away from the family. You see, I had a secret I couldn't quite figure out yet, that something wasn't right. I didn't want to shame my parents, my dad especially, and I couldn't figure it out because I still wasn't sure. But shortly, I was figuring it out. You see, I didn't like the ladies. I was attracted to the men, even though I tried very hard. I had a wonderful girlfriend engaged, but it wasn't there. And at that point in time, going to the University of Georgia and coming down here gave me an opportunity to figure it out, so I thought. But I lived an entire life through the early 40s of duality, of deception and lies. Privately, I lived in the gay lifestyle at home, but business, professionally, any place else I went, I had a woman in my arm and nobody knew. But I also learned the art of deception very well. So this was just building. This thing was building. The alcohol was starting to get me in trouble. I was reminded of the Georgia football games. That was the beginning of finding how you could smuggle it into the games and drinking. And you know what? It was not about the game. It was about the drinking. But I still didn't figure that out. I just thought that was part of the good time. Many times after the game, I'd find myself looking up, or I thought I saw a plane and falling off a wall and being in the ivy, and my friends couldn't find me, and a couple hours later they'd find me, and I'd end up in the bathtub in the apartment the rest of the night. And that was fun. Yeah, right. It was really crazy. Somewhere along those 2 years down there, I kind of figured out finally which direction, what was happening in my life all the way in. But I was very eager to be a professional and to succeed. So I didn't want any part of me to get in the way of success. Found myself going back home for a short period of time in New York. It was awful. But very shortly thereafter, I got called from Cherokee County here in Georgia to be a high school teacher, to teach horticulture. You see, I went ahead and changed. I went into the horticulture field, master of landscape design, great background in plants, and that was the love of my life, and I loved sharing it. I loved teaching. It was a great experience, except here's this Yankee, because I was still very much Yankee, with an afro, big old bell bottoms and high stacked shoes, because that was 1973. Welcome back, Cotter. And in Cherokee County, which was about as backwoods as you could get in 1973, it was almost frightening. And they were, even when I came up to interview, had a place for me to live. It was a little efficiency apartment next to this, and I said, no, I will not live up here. I'm going to live in Atlanta. And it was just an interesting experience. The teaching experience was wonderful. The administration part, The culture change was tough, and again, I had started to become very egotistical and arrogant because I thought I was better, and the school systems in the South stunk. In New York, we had such a good education, and I challenged the administration constantly because of the kids that couldn't read or write, and I wouldn't pass them. And they said, well, they're in horticulture, and I said, they still need to know how to read and write. We had lots of battles on that. And meanwhile, being a young teacher and other young teachers and the drugs and the alcohol, there was always parties. It was just complete insanity, but I still didn't see it as trouble. In May of 1977, I was teaching 4 years. After a wild party at one of the teachers' houses, I decided with my partner at the time, I had met somebody in 1974, so I guess it was 3 years into it, we stopped by the school and decided to steal some ferns and plants. Drunk, thought it was fun. Went home. On Monday, I was called into the principal's office, and I thought, okay, this is cool. Blacked out. I didn't remember. And as I walked in the office, it came to me, and I went, crap. And he was watching us from a window in the classroom take this stuff. Now, I'm not proud of it. I just tell you this because it's part of my story. It's part of what alcohol started to do. I denied it. He said, well, bring it back. I brought back part of what, and he watched it, but I just couldn't even conceive, to be honest, because I just was totally humiliated. I lost my job. I was tenured, but I lost my job because I just gave up. That was just too much to do, and that job was wonderful. What I did at that point in time was my partner and I decided, let's just sell everything and travel around the United States. Again, you know, fight or flee. Let's flee. Let's go for a geographical cure. We left. We traveled the United States for 4 months in a great van with three big dogs and had a blast. But toward the end of that 3 months, I didn't have an identity. You see, the ego needed an identity. I wasn't anybody. And I started to miss the fact that I needed to be something professionally. Colorado was our last stop. It didn't work. Came back to Georgia. The same house that we lived in was for sale. Bought that house with no job. Furnished it with no job because the people we rented it from did everything for me. Fell into a company which you may be familiar with called Pike Nurseries. I was with Pike Nurseries for 30 years. But in 1977, when I joined that company, there were 8 stores. The owner hired me. They were a wonderful family. And I was the first college graduate professional horticulturist that he had ever hired. And he told me the day he hired me that I wouldn't last 2 weeks because I was probably lazy coming from college, and school teacher hours we didn't have. But we joke about that to this day because that was probably the best thing he ever told me because it motivated me. Now, when we read Bill's story, he talks about the point where he arrived. About 5 years into that job, I arrived. I was something else, folks. That big shotism just took off because they kept promoting me. I was making some good money. I was in some of the professional organizations. And having arrived also gave me the right to party because those folks in the green industry worked hard, but darn did they play hard. Real hard, and drink and drink and drink was all they did, and that was right up my alley. Any road trip I ever went on that involved that was a thermos full of Bloody Marys to start us off. It could be 6 in the morning, it could be 10 at night, didn't matter. That was started the road trip, and off to the races. Now, a few of the things that happened in that situation and during those early years was, you know, I made a jerk of myself at some of the company functions. They laughed at me because it was acceptable, but one day Mr. Pike approached me and said, you might slow down. You might have a problem. He said, I quit. But he was like my dad. They were just good old willpower and they could quit, but he was miserable. I didn't take that omen, and I continued to do that. And through that career, it progressed and it progressed until we go on trips, and I would wake up in the hospital because I was too drunk when I came out of a bar and fell and slipped on the gravel and lost half my face. Or, worse yet, show up at the one thing we did that was part of the business trip that was business, drunk, and didn't have a clue that I was drunk. So these things were all starting to add up, but I never put two and two together. I couldn't put it together at all. It just didn't make sense. My personal life was starting to go crazy. Between the 13 years at Pike's and the 13 years in that relationship, it ended, not on my part, but that was just the wonderful catalyst for somebody that was on the road to being a good drunk to take off. By then I had found the white drug and found out that I really didn't like spending all that money on that white powder. However, boy, could I drink. It just gave me the ability to drink more, stay out later, and drive home at 9 in the morning when the cops weren't looking for a drunk driver. It wasn't about the drug. You see, I didn't like the way drugs made me feel, really, unless they enhanced or let me drink more. That's what it was about. At that point in time, shortly after the end of that, in 1987, through all of that, I started to get real crazy because I was single. I didn't care what I was doing, where I was going. I had an attempt at suicide. God had a different plan. I woke up about 36 hours later, and it was, again, no coincidences. When I woke up, the nurse that was at my side looked at me and said, "You work at Pike's, you're the manager down there." I said, "Why in the world would you do this to yourself? You are so good." That was my wake up. That no how, no way would anybody ever put me in that situation again. But see, quickly after that, I put two and two together that I really didn't want to be on this planet anymore. But I'd just drink myself and go out and sport sex myself to death, and it would be a happy ending. That's where my head was at 87. Shortly after that, I totaled a car. DUI number one. At that point in time, it was a stiff little $600 fine, a slap on the hand, a little bit of probation, and that was it. You know, it tells us in the big book that we just don't have the capacity to remember the pain and suffering of even a few hours ago. I know that today, but I didn't know it then, and I see how it was working in my life. Just that humiliation for about a week went away real quick when I got the slap on the hand. And in the back of my mind, I put this little thought process, 5 years, Wayne. 5 years, if you don't get into trouble drinking and driving, this will go away. That's how my mind thought. So for 5 years, I did my best to make sure I didn't drink and drive, or if I did, I knew the back roads. And you see, at that point in my life, it was starting to figure out how I was either not going to drink and when I could, and everything was starting to plan around drinking, not drinking. And I started to drink after the party. You see, I never made a jerk of myself. It took all the willpower I had not to drink too much at the party, but as soon as the party was over, I was out downtown somewhere drinking, trying to figure out how I'm not going to drive home. A few years after the first relationship, I met somebody that was my partner for the next 19 years. In that time frame, the first person passed away from lung cancer, 1993. The person I was with was strong enough to allow me to take care of this person. He died in my arms. And boy, was I off to the races for drinking. I had every excuse in the world at that point in time. And again, I was looking for excuses. You would drink like I was drinking if you just went through that and all of that. It wasn't long. That was in April. October of that year, I got my second DUI. And in the meantime, I was all about Wayne. From that whole period, from the time Paul died until that next DUI, I was all about me. And I was all about getting out of the house. My second partner worked in the restaurants, was always out at night working, and I was out at night working too. And I'm not real proud of that, but I was out because I didn't know what the word monogamy meant. Never did. Came from the early stages of duality, living in that. What's love and what's sex, and call it whatever excuse you want. There is none. But that's where I was at. At that point in time, with that DUI, again, it ranked as first. It didn't rank as second because of the time period. It was exactly 5 years and 4 or 5 days. That's how close. And again, when I look back on that, I just go, wow, you know, what's all that about? Well, they sent me to a drug and alcohol counselor. The lawyer said, I need that before we go, because now we're in 1993. Things are getting a little harder. I took the test, and somehow I lied my way through the test with this gentleman. But he wrote the letter for the courts and for the lawyer, and he said, I've tested Wayne Jewers and all this kind of stuff. And he said, Wayne is not an alcoholic, but if I were him, I would never drink again. That I wasn't an alcoholic, folks. You see, that was so important to me at that time, not to be classified as an alcoholic. I was just a heavy drinker or crazy. So for 18 months, from that October until March, I became a great martyr. I drank O'Doul's. But I knew 10 of them would count as a beer, so when we went away with the guys, I would drink as much as I could, almost to the point of being sick, but I knew I could get a little buzz off of 10, because 10 would equivalent to one beer. You know, that's where the thinking was. The insanity working in my life, I had no clue. I was still being very successful in the job. In fact, the boss was proud of me that I wasn't drinking, because you see, he was amazed that I didn't get killed in the accident, so he was more amazed that I brought the gory pictures of the car so that he wouldn't yell at me for getting arrested again. I knew how to work it. 18 months, no drinking. Home life was good, but I wasn't happy. I've had a beautiful home. I'm in the same home I've been in for 35 years. At that point in time, I was working for Pike for 20. Everything was going for me, so how could I be an alcoholic? How could I be a drunk? Hanging on to a relationship, hung on to a job, own a home. Life was sweet, but I sure did like to party. March 5th of 1995. My mother had moved down from New York and decided to rescue my mom. She was up there alone. None of the kids could take care of her. I brought her down. The big shot, Wayne. Let me take care of mom and everybody look at what I'm doing. Brought her down, but I brought down a drunk. Because she had been in AA for 9 years, and she was very active in her alcoholism. The rest is her story. However, being a good drunk, and I hadn't touched or even wanted a drink for 18 months because I was such a good martyr, there was a bottle of Absolut in the refrigerator, in the freezer. And I decided to drink at her. I'll show her. So I drank most of that bottle of Absolut. And when I drank, I didn't stay home. I ended up downtown. And at 4 o'clock that night, I found myself up on a telephone pole at the corner of Cheshire Bridge and Piedmont, that crazy little wedge that's always there that I always would hit the curb and get a flat tire or something when I was drinking. This time I hit the telephone pole with the cop sitting right up there in the bakery arresting somebody else. It was over. You see, on that night, I looked up in the air, I raised my hands and said, "Okay, God, whatever." The other two DUIs, I was the best actor in the world. I cried, I hollered, "If I get arrested, I go to jail, this is my job." This one, I looked at the policeman, I refused the breathalyzer because I just decided we weren't going to get a number. I didn't say a peep. I went to jail. I spent the time I needed to in jail. I bailed myself out with a credit card. Didn't even call home and say where I was. And at that point in time, I knew I was done. But I revived myself a few hours later with, "Let's come up with one more good lie. Why were you where you were?" And I festered this great lie of a friend in need that was dying from a chronic illness, and I was down there, and that's why I drank, and I was upset. And I told it so many times that I believed it. The lawyer believed me until he read the police report and saw what I had done and what the cop said. And then he said, "You're going to go get some counseling." Now, mind you, in my mind, I hadn't drank for 18 months. I hadn't touched a drop of alcohol. And I had no idea of the progressiveness or the disease of alcoholism, so I didn't know what happened on March 6th when I hit that booze and how fast it took effect and how it passed where I was at. But I wasn't going to go to a treatment center because I didn't have a drinking problem. I needed to go to an insane asylum because I was crazy. That's where I was in my head. I was just totally crazy. My relationship with God in all of that time was zip. The first 16 years of my life, I'd lived in a church. I was an altar boy. I was of the Episcopal faith. I was going to be a priest. But you know what? When I decided I liked the men and all that other stuff started coming out, I wasn't worthy of this God. And coming south, I was promoted to the doom and gloom and the condemnation. So I just said, "See ya." I came up with my own idea of what I thought was God, and that was whatever I needed it to be when I needed it to be. So when I called out for God that night, it was a sincere call for something out there that I didn't know where it came from. On the 4th of April of 95, it took 30 days almost from the DUI till I finally got to a drug and alcohol counselor, and I was at that point that many of us know in your gut. I couldn't live, didn't want to be here, and I didn't want to die. And I was scratching at everything that I could imagine to please get me out of this. I don't want to go through this. I was dead, but not. Pain that I couldn't, never felt, and had never felt since. Whew. And I'm glad I can still remember that last drink. It was not a pretty night. But it still took me 30 days of trying to manifest that lie till I want this. At that time, I would not call her this wonderful woman, but to this day, when I talk about her and I have her permission to use her name, this little short Jewish lady who was just a therapist, Irene Bernson, and I walked into her office. She complimented me, and I couldn't handle compliments. And she had me take the test, and I took the test and thought I could lie again. And when I was done, she said, "You failed the test." And I said, "No, I didn't." And she questioned me, and she caught me. She asked me why I was out, and I told her that lie that I had believed. By the time I told it, at that time when I was telling her, it didn't work for me either. And she looked at me and she called me an effing liar. then she looked at me and said, "Do you think you're an intelligent man?" I said, "Yes, I went to college, got a college education, got a great job." She said, "What intelligent person would find themselves in jail three times, find themselves coming up with a lie like this, doing what you've done to a partner, and think you're smart?" She had me. And all I could do was that. That's all I could do. She said, "Okay, here's what we're going to do. You're going to go to an AA meeting, and you're going to go to three AA meetings a week. And after you do a week, you're going to come back." And I went, "AA meeting?" She said, "Don't you get it?" And I said, "No." She said, "You will." I called that night when I got home, central office here in Atlanta, and I asked them where there were AA meetings. Explained my situation, that I was in Roswell, and I, again, still manifested in delusion of fantasy, said I might be gay. I'm going to admit it. And she told me about the Galano Club, and I said, "No, that's not for me." She said, "Well, there's a meeting at 8111 Club, and there's several of them, but tomorrow night there's a men's meeting at 8 o'clock at 8111 Club." Now, the men's meeting sounded interesting to me. So I went to the men's meeting, scared to death. When I came up to the clubhouse, if it wasn't for this wonderful man, who's still very much in my life, he's 93 years old, Bill M., and grabbed me by the arm and said, "You're new." Like, how did he know? I was a deer in headlights. And he said, "Follow me." And he walked in with me. I sat next to him. And I probably was in the most terrified mode that I've ever been in my life. I couldn't move, but I heard. You see, I heard this meeting happening, where a discussion leader talked about what he had done to his mom because he was also a drug addict and stole from her and did this. But he also spoke about this elevator and where you could get off an elevator. And he spoke about the not yet. And I understood right then and there the not yet, because I hadn't done that yet. I also knew I was where I belonged. As scared as I was, I knew where I was, and that's where I belonged. But I was also terrified, because at my eye level sitting, I could only see the ninth step. And it scared the fire out of me, folks, because I knew where I had been. I knew what I did. And I didn't think I could ever undo that, or ever look a person in the eye and make those amends. It's just where I was, first meeting. But I was already 5 years ahead, because I had no clue about one day at a time. The best thing I heard in that meeting, and I always talk about it when I share in a newcomer's meeting, or when there's a newcomer in the room, the only thing that really stuck and made me go, was all I had to do was not drink today. That was the most important thing that was said that I heard, because I had no idea how I was going to live life without drinking. I had hoped that you folks were going to tell me how not to drink and drive. That was where I was coming from when I came in, still hoping that I could drink. But I knew I was done. That day, that moment, I was done. And there was some freedom to it, because for the first time in 30 days of excuses, the excuses were over. And I knew it, and I was okay with it. There were no more excuses. And I wasn't different. There were people like me in the room, and they had done the same thing, and they were laughing about it, even though I didn't find any of it humorous. But I wasn't alone. Now, the other thing I heard was, keep coming back, because I didn't understand a whole lot. But I did have that hour of, I'm okay. Not that hour of terror and fear and frustration that was always there. At the end of the meeting, and this is funny, and it may not be funny to you, but it's part of my story, and it's one of the funniest things. when I was out on the prowl, call it what you want, when you go out and you're cheating and running around, you always get cards and phone numbers, and you always throw them away. Because you can't go home, especially if in your relationship with cards and phone numbers. Imagine you'll get caught. So my first meeting, when men come up to me and give me their phone numbers on cards, I freaked. I threw them away. I can't go home with these. Now again, it might not, to me it was very significant, because like, what do I do here? Now one man came up to me and he took a meeting list. And he took the meeting list, and on the back of our meeting list has a place for names. And he put his name and his phone number. A few days later, that's the person I called. But it took a few days, because sponsorship, again, being from a fraternity, being from hazing, being from all of that, I thought, uh-oh, we aren't going through that. You need a sponsor. And that was just, again, where my head was at. However, this man, he would never have put the two of us together in a million years. Ever. My therapist at that time was amazed that I was asking a man. In the land of us gay folks, we're often suggested that if you're a man, you get a woman sponsor. Woman, get a male sponsor. I was insistent that I needed to walk through discomfort and work through that part of my life, because I was always fearful of men. And I needed to work through that. Don't ask me why at 3-4 days sober, but I just knew that there was something more to this special program. I also knew that there was a God, because I saw him up on the steps. And I knew that that's what I called out, and I kind of chuckled, okay, the last laugh is here. From that point on, things started to get better. Now, I won't tell you that life was getting better, because you see, the freight train crashed. The engine hit that telephone pole on March 6th. April 5th, everything was suspended in slow motion, but those cars continued to come. 14 days, I was going to court about not doing the breathalyzer. 30 days, I was going to see the judge about the DUI, and they kept coming. And they kept coming, but they weren't a big deal. Because everybody said, you'll be all right. And I had embraced the program, and I found this wonderful textbook called The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I read it, I immediately identified with it. Of course, my sponsor told me after 3 days to go back and read the print. But I was looking for my answer, and I was starting to find it in this book. And starting to understand what was going on and why I ticked like I ticked. More importantly, what the solution was. And the solution was in the steps. You see, and we started to embrace the steps. And I found a great meeting called the Dawnbusters meeting that was a 7 a.m. meeting up there at 8111 Club. Small meeting. But it started my day off, and it shut this down. Because in the morning when I wake up, it's going. And I always could go to another meeting in the evening. Then I found a Sunday beginners meeting at that club that's always been good. And on a Friday night, all in 14 days, found the Roswell group, which is my home group. The Roswell Presbyterian group up in Roswell meets on Friday night at 8:30. And it was loaded with sobriety beyond my imagination. 20 plus years, most of the people. So I had from a newcomers meeting to that, and I found a big book meeting and a step meeting in between, and I lived in meetings. It was incredible. And you see, I had no idea what was happening. But that usual trip with Pike Nurseries was coming up in June, and we always went deep sea fishing, and we partied hard, and this was going to be my first trip. At 3 or 4 days before, I went to the doctor because I always got seasick and I wanted to get a patch. And for some reason, when I went to the doctor, I decided that I hadn't been to a doctor in a long time. Let's get a physical. Let's get some blood work. Went the trip, had a ball, didn't want to drink, didn't have an urge. And when I came home, went to the doctor. And on my 70th day of sobriety, I found I was HIV positive. I cried for 5 minutes. I said, okay, God, that moment in time, I had my spiritual awakening because God had a plan beyond what I could ever imagine. Because had I found out before I was sober, I wouldn't be here. Absolutely guarantee you. What you people taught me at 70 days was the solution. The solution for that problem wasn't in these rooms, but there was a place to go for support. And I went there. And you know, it was 6 months into the program and all that my counselor, Irene, said, "You don't need this anymore. You've got enough good things going on." And slowly the other thing, I didn't need as much, because you people, this program, the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, gave me the tools that I needed to have a wonderful life. You see, I did my first 4-step. And when I get that 5th step and release that, the promise says we could look the world in the eyes. My head came from the ground to your eyes with no shame, no remorse, no fear. I was 6 months sober. At that same time, I found the men's workshop, the Atlanta Men's Workshop down at Rock Eagle, which we'll be going to this weekend. This will be my 28th workshop. That first workshop, 6 months sober, 300 men, scared to death. I went down there and found who I really was, and that it was okay. I was loved unconditionally, and my terminal uniqueness fell off me like scales. And I promise, it's not just, they fell away. Because I could share all of this stuff intimately, one-on-one, and go to meetings. And I found something that really worked. I have not missed a workshop since. Every 6 months, it's a recharge. I'm an active member of the committee. And all of that has just totally saved my life and keeps me in the middle of the bed with Alcoholics Anonymous. My life's been good. I'm healthier than I've ever been. Things are going great, and there's really not a lot to complain about. Has it been an easy road? No. You know, I was still with the same company. All the things I wanted as a drunk with that company, 3 years after I got sober, I was promoted to a vice president, and I didn't want it. It was like, ew. It's too much responsibility. But you know, I took it, and I wrote it, and did what was expected, and wore it like I should as a professional. And I did that. In the early 2000s, the company was sold by the family to an investment group here in Atlanta. And that was pretty shattering, even for this alcoholic who thought this could be better. It was one of those situations that was very difficult at the time to see the family walk away from the business. However, knowing that corporate America could take us further, could, again, Wayne was still thinking about Wayne. I'm not cured. More salary, more this, all that would be good. At any rate, I'm doing for time. Running out of time here. They sold the company through bankruptcy, and the company was bought by Armstrong a year ago March, and that changed everything. January of 08, January 3rd, my partner of 19 years walked out with an email, "I've moved out." March of 08, I found myself through minor surgery, hemorrhaging, lost 4 pints of blood, strep infection, with a desire to live like you've never seen. And I pulled through. September 29th of 08, they terminated me after 30 years. Folks, I tell you that not to impress you, to impress upon you that no matter what, when, where, or how, what this is all about is how to live sober. I never wanted a drink, never thought about a drink. And each time you people reminded me that there's something better. There's a solution. The solution for the partner was sad. I don't want to be single. But you know what? God has a different plan. I'm learning who I am, what I need to be, and maybe the next go-round, if there is one, will be healthier. Physically, because the Pike Nursery is gone out of my life, I've had the best physicals, the best blood work you could ever imagine. They ask what's different. No more stress. Those last 5 years of that company were horrible. The day I lost my job, when I got off the elevator, I said one thing. I had a part. You see, I quit when that company took over. And I did it. And for me to do that at that point in time and have no remorse, I did it. I had a part in losing that job because they fired me for poor performance. And they were right. I went to an AA meeting immediately, 11:30. After that, I went and got my own cell phone because I never had to have one. I went to church and prayed for the man that fired me. And the next day, I started with a friend of mine, my own company. And since then, I have a couple of them. And I'm having a blast. But I also know what kind of employee I am. A lot of times, I'm lazy. I have to fire myself in the morning. I rehire myself. Life is great. Life is great. And again, the message I leave, no matter what, a drink is only going to mess up this beautiful gift I've been given by a loving God that is incredible and continues to work in my life like I've never known. I found the God of my childhood. I'm back involved in all of that. The big book tells us, and somehow he had a great last joke there too. I couldn't want anything else. It tells us, and I was going to read that, but because of time, it tells us in the last story in the big book, third edition, that we are given everything we need. We won't have everything we want. Today I have everything I need, and the most important thing is I love the man I've become. I embrace Wayne. Pimples, warts, anger, whatever comes out, that's who I am today. But that's okay, because one day at a time I continue to get better as long as I don't take a drink. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Wayne. You cast your net into the deep end tonight. We really appreciate it. Seventh tradition states that there are no dues or fees for AA membership, but your contributions help us out here and at the zone, so we appreciate your generosity. And may I have a volunteer to give out the chips? Great. Helen Moore.
I'm still my mother. I'm an alcoholic named Helen Moore. And we have the chip system here and throughout the Southeast. We have a white chip for anybody who's new or coming back to this program, one day at a time. We have a silver chip. Well, really, it's aluminum. A silver chip for 30 days, 30 consecutive days and nights. We have a red chip for 3 months. We have a gold chip for 6 months. We have a green chip for 9 months. We have a blue chip for years, for a year or years or multiples thereof. How many takers tonight for a white chip? Doing my contest. That was a wonderful story, Wayne. Thanks. 30 days? Anybody got 30 days? 3 months? 90 days? 6 months? Gold chip? 9 months? Green chip? The program's growing on you then. our blue chip in a year, years you're there for. Okay, thanks. There you go.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, do we have any AA-related announcements?
My name is Mark, an alcoholic.
Hey, Mark.
I have the keys of the business cabinet, and I'm one of my meetings in the And Halloween night, October 31st, Halloween mansion in this room right here. Costume dance room.
Okay, Saturday, October 31st, is a dance here, 9:30, right after the 8 o'clock 12 and 12 meeting, October 31st, and it's a bargain at any price. And next week, Kia W. from the Triangle Evening Group. She will be telling her story. And the week after that, Troy Lee, who is real active in this meeting for quite some time, recently, a couple of years back, he will be telling his story. And we're looking forward to having Troy back here. So, any other announcements? Okay, I'd like to remind everyone that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions. Ever remind us to place principles before personalities, and for those who will, join us in the Lord's Prayer. Who always makes a great meeting?
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. Keep coming back to the work to the world.
Thank you for coming. We'll take care of that.
Thank you. you.
Is it your name Tim?
Almost never.